Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, chair of the club's grown-ups forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to listen to us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Francine Toder. Francine Toder is an emeritus faculty member of California State University, Sacramento, and is a clinical psychologist, recently retired from private practice. She's also the author of When Your Child Is Gone, Learning to Live Again, and Your Kids Are Grown, Moving On With and Without Them, both critically acclaimed. Her extensive writing on diverse topics has appeared in magazines, professional journals, and edited book chapters. She resides with her husband in the San Francisco Bay Area, where she practices cello daily. Dr. Toder.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I'm really, really happy to be here tonight and delighted that so many of you have come out to hear what I have to say, and I hope that it speaks to you. I think it will, because this is a stage of life that is the absolute largest stage that any of us will have to deal with in our lives. And it's also the best in some ways, and I'm going to tell you about the ways in which I think it is best. So here you are, and you're wondering what I could possibly tell you about the arts, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I even decided to write this book. Well, about 3 years ago, when I was getting ready to retire, although this book doesn't really have anything to do with retirement, I was at retirement age. Actually, well beyond it. I'd been a psychologist all my life, and I'd been a psychologist for more than 45 years. And I was beginning to think, is there anything else I can do? And if not now, when? And these turn out to be some of the quintessential questions of the vintage years. We begin to think, well, whatever time I have left, if I don't try out the things I want, if I don't find a new interest or excitement or passion now, when will I? And so this particular stage in life is really critical for looking at that. But I'd never done anything besides be a psychologist. And yes, I wrote a couple of books, but I didn't consider myself a writer. And as far as being an artist, I had no background in art whatsoever. In fact, if anything, I was sort of on the intellectual side and definitely not very right-brained. And we'll talk more about sides of the brain. So I thought, well, what actually could I do? And at that time, I went online looking for some inspiration, and I knew that I loved music, and I knew that I loved the cello best of all. I loved the sound. It was deep and mellow, and it resonated with me just to the core of my soul. But I was a listener. The only thing I played was the, were CDs on... I had no talent. Of course, I'm going to talk about talent. At this stage of life, you don't need talent. It isn't relevant. It's hard enough to make a living as an artist when you're young. You know that you aren't in this to make any money, to become famous, to do anything like that. If anything, you're in this to please yourself. That's what the stage is about, and I will talk about that. But I knew I loved the cello, and everyone I told, I think I'll play the cello, they said, are you crazy? Try the recorder. That's the thing that eight-year-olds learn how to play in elementary school. It's simpler. I said, but I don't want simple. If I'm lucky, I'll have 30 years left, and I want to do something extraordinary. I want to do something that makes me feel wonderful, not an instrument because it's simple and because I could probably do it rather easily. But everyone I talk to, and I know a lot of musicians, they all kind of said, well, it's kind of a hard instrument, It doesn't have frets. You don't know where to put your fingers. It's really heavy. You'll have to lug it around. And the more I heard, the more I was convinced, like some of you probably understand right now, I want to do what I want to do. That's part of being in the vintage years as well. I don't want to do what other people want me to do. I don't want to do what other people expect me to do. I want to do what my passion says or my interest says or my curiosity says. So I went online looking for permission to do this thing. Like, there must be somebody out there who's as old as I am. And what I found was there was a cello teacher in New York, a young cello teacher whose name is Bianca Kovic, and she did a year-long experiment to try to find an older person to teach the cello to in return for doing a documentary with that person, demonstrating that they could, in fact, learn how to play the cello. She spent a year, and a lot of people were kind of timid, or they were discouraged, or they just thought, no, I can't do this. But she found a woman who was willing to try, and her name was Maddie, and she was 89. And she lived in New York City independently. However, she was a widow, and many of her friends and family had moved on one way or another, and she was kind of lonely, and she was beginning to feel kind of shut in. Well, the documentary was extraordinary. It's available. You can see it online. You can buy it, and I refer to it in the book. I saw Maddie in the course of, a couple of months play the cello. Now, she's not Yo-Yo Ma, and, of course, neither am I, and that isn't the goal when you get to this stage. But she looked like she was having fun. What's more, it opened up vistas in her life that had not been available in many, many years. She had a new community. She had new things to talk about. She felt energized. She felt like she had a new companion, because when you, well, with the cello, I happen to know about that, but when you put the cello next to your body, first of all, when you wrap your arms around it, as you have to do to play it, it's like hugging somebody. And when you actually play it, you can feel vibrations in your chest. It's really an amazing, and it's the only instrument that there is where you are holding it that close that you can feel it while you play it. So I was pretty inspired, and so I dragged my husband to San Francisco, and I knew about a shop that rented stringed instruments, and I walked in and walked out with a rented cello, a case, and a bow. And then I just took it home, and then I went online, and I bought a book, a stand, and a metronome. And I thought, okay, I'm all set. But of course I had no idea how to hold it or what to do with it. I certainly didn't know how to tune it, and I certainly didn't know what. And I made some scratchy sounds as I tried vainly to pull the bow across. But that was 3 years ago. I did find a teacher, and I did start playing, and I was, I was a little short of 70 when I started. So, it can be done, I can assure you, because I did it. But at the same time, as I was thinking about retiring, I was thinking about writing another book. As you hear from the titles of my other books, which span like a 30-year period, I wanted to write something about the stage of life. I really wanted to. That's how I learn, by writing and doing research. Maybe that's how psychologists are. And I thought, what can I learn about this stage of life that I was in that would be the largest stage that I would ever be in? And I wanted to know how I could survive the next 30 or longer years healthfully. What would be the best bang for the buck in terms of my body, my psyche, and my brain? Now, because I was a psychologist, I knew a little bit about the psyche, and I thought, okay, I've got that one. But physically, that was important, and so some of what takes place in the book is talking about ways to physically attend to yourself so that you can do your art form. Because most of the visual artists and all of the musicians experience some physicality. The writers have it a little bit easier, but all the writers I've talked to have a physical exercise regime to prepare them for their writing. So I said, okay, that's 2 out of 3. Now what about the brain? So when I was in graduate school 45 years ago, what I learned about brain science and how the brain function could fill maybe 3 pages in a notebook, handwritten. That was it. And basically what you learned was that the brain at about age 30 begins its steep decline, end of story. And that was that. But the good news was I was in my 20s, so I really didn't care. It was like, okay, that's nice, next subject. So that was kind of irrelevant, but when I started to think about writing a book, then it became extremely relevant, and I thought, I need to do research on what's happened in brain science in the last 30 years, because a lot really has happened. And so I'm going to be talking later about both changes in the brain that facilitate taking on an art form at this stage of life and why this is the best stage to do it, and also how using your art form strengthens the brain. So enough about that. Let me show you my first slide. I should say that when I got started writing the book, I thought, well, an N of one is useless. I'm a scientist. I can't extrapolate from my own experience, or not so far. And I didn't want it to be a memoir. It wasn't about me that I was writing. It was about all of us. And so I thought, I have to interview a lot of people. And I thought, well, I'm someone who needs structure. So if I was going to retire, I needed to work on this book for 10 years. So I probably would interview 500 people and find out how they got to do their art form. And also, one of the criteria was that I wasn't going to interview anyone who had an art form that they had experienced from childhood and early adulthood and middle adulthood. I wanted people who tried something brand new when they got to what I call the vintage years, which is roughly 55 and on. So I thought, I'll just have lots of people, and I'll have all kinds of data, and then I'll write the book. So I took my tape recorder, and I went to visit people who knew people who knew people here and on the East Coast. And after I interviewed 25 people in depth, and, of course, if there's anything a psychologist can do, it's interview people in depth. If you ever want to, you know about anyone's childhood, you just ask a psychologist about that. So these were in-depth interviews, and I couldn't bear to turn these people into data points. They were so fascinating, and they were just ordinary people. They weren't famous artists. And when I say artists, I'm talking about writers, musicians, and visual artists. And they'd all started later in life, but they all had such a fabulous story, and I thought, you know what? This book is going to be about more than 20 artists, and they're going to fill the middle of my book. And so the middle 100 pages are in-depth stories about more than 20 artists. I don't know if it's 21, 23. And each one of them has like 5 or 7 pages. Because I thought anyone who's reading the book really wants to know, how did they get to be this way? How did they figure it out? What did they do? Who were they as kids? Where did they grow up? What kind of support did they get? And so I'm going to tell you the story about some of them tonight. And by the way, I'm not going to read from the book. I think, in general, that makes kind of a boring talk, because I'm then just talk. You know, if you want to read the book, read the book. So, so here is the first artist I wanted to share with you tonight. There he is, Henry. Henry was 96 when I interviewed him. About a year and a half ago. And he is a wood sculptor. He's also an organist. Now, I didn't interview him because he was an organist, but I had my little droid phone camera with me, and of all the pictures I took, this one came out best. But there is a wood sculpture of his behind the music on the wall. Henry used to, when he was 68, he started being a wood sculptor, and he would lug around large chunks of wood, like tree trunks. And, of course, he's 90. When I interviewed him, he was 96. He walked with a walker. He lives independently. He's very sharp. He drives a car. He's a widower. But he doesn't drag, you know, tree trunks around anymore. So now he very comfortably transitioned into smaller works, but he's still a wood sculptor. It was only later that I found out, sort of toward the end of the interview, that he was also an organist, and he didn't start doing his organ playing until he was close to 80, and then he never played the organ, and someone gave him one, and wasn't this one, this is his, you know, beefed up one that we got when he really enjoyed it a lot. But he composes music. He writes songs. And there he is at the organ playing a song that he composed for me. Not even composed it for me. He composed it and he played it for me. And it was just delightful. But I want to talk a little bit about Henry's life, because that's really what's important. So Henry grew up at a time where when you wanted to play, you made your own toys. And no Toys R Us around the corner and nothing plastic. So he got a penknife when he was 7. And he would take little blocks of wood and he would carve them into little cars, little trains, little, you know, objects that move. And then he'd wrap some rubber bands around it and shoot it across the floor. Some of you may remember that, although you all look like you're too young to remember some of that. So that's what he did, and I thought that was really interesting. And it never occurred to him that his interest in wood cutting then might be related to his current interest, which he didn't start until he was 68 and retired. But talking about other things he made as he was a child, I said, anything else go on in your childhood I should know about? And he said, well, I once made a car out of a cake of ivory soap. Now, most people don't use cakes of ivory soap anymore, though I bet everyone here, well, with the exception of a few people, probably know what that is, because there weren't that many options when we were kids. I mean, ivory soap was the standard. So he took his penknife and he carved it into a car, and he said, you know what? He said, I still have it. Well, I got goosebumps. I said, you're kidding. That was like 90 years before. And I said, do you know where it is? He said, I do. And he went and got it. And here was this little brown cake of, well, it didn't look like soap anymore. It was a little brown object carved into the shape of a car. And he still had it. Now, this is pretty interesting because this guy has lived all over. And in truthfully, in 90 years, you do live all over. And he dragged it around with him. He never thought about why. And he never thought about wood sculpting after he was a kid and didn't need to make toys anymore. That, I thought, was pretty amazing, because in some ways it was the antecedent of what he did later, but it never occurred to him. He didn't even put it together until I looked at it, and partly because only psychologists can look at your life in a glance. You know, people don't do that for themselves. And so I connected his early childhood with his late, you know, adulthood, his vintage years, and it made total sense to him. But then I said to him, well, what did you do as an adult in your working years? You want to take a guess, anybody, about what he did? Everyone says engineer. Some people say, well, you know, go for the intellectual, you know, maybe he was a lawyer or, you know, college professor. Well, what he was, and then you'll all get a kick out of this, he was a butcher. What does a butcher do? Carves meat. Well, you know what? He had never even put these three things together. It's just that when he was 68, he decided that he wanted to do something different for all the same reasons you're all here and we all do, is that what else is there, and if not now, when? So that's Henry, and he's still happily woodworking, and independent of his limitations. And he's very sharp, and I thought, wow, if this is the way everyone is, you know, at 96, because they take up an art form, then we've really got something here. And I think we do. Let me introduce you to another one. Whoops, went the wrong way. This is Don, who's a fiddler. So Don is in his 80s, and he lives up at the top of Mount Diablo. He spent his career as a physicist, and when he retired, he wanted a quiet life. He's kind of an introverted guy. He likes his own space and quiet, and he built a log cabin sort of at the top of the mountain, which is quite a challenge to get to interview him, going around and around and never being sure I was going the right way. And he was going to, you know, raise cows and sheep, mostly, sheep and goats, I'm sorry, because of the altitude, and that was what he was going to do with his time. And he was finished working, and he was just going to hang out, he and his wife. But one, and so he was in his 60s, maybe 61 when he retired, and he was 62 or 63 when he went to visit a sister of his in Canada. And before he left, she said, "I have two fiddles, take one." And he thought, "That's odd, why do I need a fiddle? You know, he had no interest in playing a fiddle, he'd never played a fiddle. I think he played a clarinet in high school for a year and then didn't work out. And doesn't work out in high school for a lot of reasons. I'll tell you why soon. And he took the fiddle home and he sort of put it on the side where he noticed it occasionally. And then after a while, started fiddling with it. And he made as much music as I was able to make on the cello, zero. But he was curious about it. And that is the thing that is sort of marks this stage in life. You know, we have the curiosity, we're interested, and we have the space and time to be able to look at things a little differently. So he did what most people do. He found a class, he found a teacher, he started playing. All right, so this is 15 years later when I interviewed him. I interviewed him in his home office studio. There's a rafter on the ceiling, and I noticed that there were like 8 violins hanging from the rafter. And by the way, the difference between a fiddler and a violinist is only the kind of music that they play, the style of music. But he wasn't interested in classical music. He does bluegrass and country western and things like that. But I asked him about the violins. Why are those violins hanging there? He said, "Oh, I made them." And I was just, and the violin you're looking at, he made. Now, he started to tell me, seeing that I was interested, took me sort of in the back room where he could show me what it looks like disassembled, the parts, how they relate to each other. It was way too technical for me. I appreciated it, but I didn't understand most of it. But the point is, he had no interest in the fiddle. It was quite by accident. So that's the other way things happen in the vintage years. Accidentally. You know, you go to a talk like this, or you meet someone for lunch, or a flyer comes in the mail, and I'm going to talk about others, you know, for whom this happened. And you go, I wonder about that. Either I thought once I'd like to do that, or I'm looking for something to do. But so Don is quite good. He actually played for me. A lot of musicians would not play for me, and that was fine, because I won't play for anybody else, because it's not about anybody else. This is the first stage in life where you can remember what you want, when you want, and for whom you want. There are no grades, and if someone else doesn't like it, too bad. He actually plays for an hour every morning, but he plays before his wife wakes up out of respect for her, so that she doesn't have to listen to him. And yet, I thought his playing was quite good. He was willing to play for me. But it's not about being good or not. The other thing I want to say is that in the last few years, Don has had some vision problems. But one of the things that I've learned with the fine arts is the artists learn to accommodate whatever it is they have to deal with. And it's pretty amazing the ways in which you can accommodate whatever the limitations are. He now plays so that he has much brighter light shining on any music that he has to read. And he's adapting, and he's comfortable adapting. And this stage of life is sort of characterized by acceptance. And we don't fight, you know, to have something be some way. There's acceptance and ways of working around whatever the limitations are. Now, this is the only slide I'm going to bore you with that's a bunch of words, but I think the words are important. Age is not pathology and decline is not inevitable. That has become my mantra. Yes, you hear about disease. In fact, you hear about disease way too much, way more than you need to. It kind of annoys me when I pick up a magazine or go online and or read my AARP bulletin, and it's full of stuff about disease and limitations and problems. And I want to say, yeah, but that's true for some of us, but most of us are fine. We're going to live to be whatever age we are pretty healthily. And only small percentages of people wind up with a disease. And there are very few diseases associated with aging, by the way, per se. So that's really important to keep in mind. Every 7 seconds, someone turns 55. Every day for the next 18 years, 10,000 baby boomers will reach age 65. Someone's already born who will live to be 150. Imagine how much spare time you have then. Although I did talk to someone who had some political concerns about that, because, you know, then he says, well, then we need to work till we're 90, and that's just not reasonable for most people. But that's not a problem most of us have to deal with. This is the first time in history that most of us over 60 may have a third of our lives left to live, and how we spend that time after 60 is critical to our well-being. And that was the point I wanted to make. That was what I wanted this book to be about, and that's what all my talking is about. The mature brain thrives on the very things that are pleasurable and add zest to life: creativity plus physical, social, and mental activity. And all of that you will find in the fine arts. And as Lincoln said, and in the end, it's not the years in your life that count, it's the life in your years. So here's the first stage in life. You all know that one because you all had it, or you know someone who had, well, and you know someone who had it, or you know a kid currently, or you have a grandchild, or you watch kids play at the park. They are totally uninhibited, and they have great creativity, and it's a pleasure to watch. And this is the stage in life where some people do take up a musical instrument, violin, Suzuki violin playing, or kids are great at the visual arts. You know, if you've ever seen a kid with finger paints, you know what I mean. And it's great, except for one thing, that the state, it doesn't last very long, because by the time kids go to school, and this is necessary to socialize people, they have to start fitting inside of the box, and that really isn't good from an artist's perspective. So fitting inside of the box also means drawing inside of the lines, and you can't be an artist if you draw inside of the lines. But there are a few kids that are so good that they get others' attention, and they are mentored and nourished and supported, and these are, you know, the child prodigies and the early identified gifted people, you know, like Mozart. I don't have to say who they are because you know who they are. So they're exceptions, but that's maybe 2% of the population. So 98% of us weren't so gifted, weren't so talented, didn't show this ability, or didn't have the passion and zeal that you also need as a kid to go the long haul. So I'm talking to all of you who probably fit in that category. By the way, how many of you did, as young children or even adolescents, take up one of the fine art forms? Okay, good. So I'd say more than half of you had something that you did as a kid. Okay, so think about it now in terms of timeline. You did it as a kid, maybe you did it as an adolescent. How many of you kept that sort of late adolescence, early 20s, 30? How many of you kept to your art form? Okay, so the numbers have dwindled by at least half, maybe two-thirds. Okay, so now let's keep going, because you're old enough to have had a few more years under your belt. So how many of those who had their hands up continued their art form into their early, you know, their 40s and their 50s? Three or four. Okay. So that's actually pretty good for an audience, because often, you know, there are a lot of people start out as kids, and by the time they're adolescents, a lot of distractions, can't do it anymore, or you're just not good, and or you'd rather hang out with your friends. Or like my husband, I love to use my husband as an example of this. He played the violin as a child, and when he got to middle school, he had to take two public buses, and there was no way he was going to carry that violin case on public buses. You know, it just wasn't cool. So again, if he was extremely talented, no offense, Joe, but if he were, then he would have been able to continue it. He would have been mentored and helped to bring his talent out. But without that, it's really, really hard for most people. And all of the artists basically had a story about how they started doing something and then they just couldn't. But these years, of the creative years of the early childhood, also because the right brain is the part of the brain that's most active, and that is the, you know, the fertile green pasture where things really grow. But I'll talk more about that side of the brain in a little while. So this is a stage that all of you can relate to, pretty much. This is adulthood. And anyone who's 40 can relate to this, and today more so than ever, because of all the multitasking that we do. Well, so there's no way in midlife most people take on an art form. It's just too difficult. By the time you finish, find a career or a job, find a home, find a partner, build a family if that's what you choose, and then start dragging the kids from here to there, soccer practice and whatnot, then if you're lucky, you have time to sleep, and that's about it. Every single person I interviewed said, no way, all I could do is sort of keep my wits together by doing everything I had to do. There was just no time for taking on anything else. So this is not a stage that really is conducive to taking on a fine art form. Although if you started one early, you might have been able to continue it. But most people just don't have the time. And most people are very good at sacrificing their own needs to take care of whoever is in their family constellation. Well, okay, then comes the vintage years. Now, I like to think about it as 55 and on, but this, since I made it up, it could be any age. You know, that's just my definition. Could be 60, could be 50, might be 70, as in my case when I really didn't retire till close to 70. But this is a time where there's openness, there's space, there's time. It's independent of whether you are working or not. Because even if you are working, it's a stage of life. So if you had kids, they're probably grown up. Yeah, they might have come back to live with you again, but you don't have the, you know, moment-to-moment kind of responsibility that you have with young children. So this is a time where you go, wow, I like the space, and then you go, uh-oh, what am I supposed to do with it? Now, some people know right away, and the people I interviewed knew very well what they wanted to do. I interviewed a psychologist, and he was a very well-known psychologist, and he had never done any art in his life, but he remembered when he was a child, he lived in Greenwich Village, and he had a cousin who was a painter, and his cousin painted in the basement. He used to go into the basement to visit his cousin painting, and the smell of the paints were very powerful. And he had olfactory memories, and olfactory memories are very powerful. And he remembered the smell of paint his whole life, and he thought, as soon as I retire, I'm going to paint. And so he planned it, and like the day after he retired, he found a course, and he started painting. He's more unusual than most of the people. Most people kind of started and stopped and fumbled and bumbled and didn't know where they were going, but some people really do know. But it's, again, independent of whether you're working or not, because it's a mindset as well. The other thing that happens in this stage is that there are some hormonal changes that actually contribute to the ability to focus deeply, and those are the sex hormones, estrogen and testosterone. I mean, just think about what the purpose of sex hormones are. They don't really fit as robustly in this stage of life because they aren't necessary, and that stuff is hardwired. So when that drops off, then some of the kind of competition and striving and issues that are sort of typical of adulthood, early adulthood, are no longer there. And because of that, my artists are able to concentrate in ways you cannot concentrate at any other stage in life. And there's evidence, there is neurological evidence for that. Okay, so wisdom. This is another hallmark of the vintage years. This is my definition, so if you're a scientist and you want to quibble with me, that's okay. accumulation and synthesis of knowledge through a library of patterns and a lifetime of experience. The patterns are formed in the brain, and I can talk a little bit more about that, but I go into it a lot more in detail in the book. And by the way, I would love to tell you everything that's in the book, but we can't do it in an hour. So I'm going to mention some things, and if you're curious, you can see them later. But a lot of young people think that wisdom comes from Google and Wikipedia. You know, if you ask somebody the definition of anything, they'll pull out their computer or their iPad or their cell phone and try to tell you. But when you are in the vintage years, you have the wisdom. You have, your brain has shortcut, taken everything you ever known and made it really available to you. Now, I know some people are going to say, oh yeah, but what about those senior moments? But those are things that are pretty inconsequential that you forget, like what you ate last night or the movie you saw last week or where you put your keys or, God forbid, your best friend's name. You know, we all have moments like that. But in general, when you learn something like an art form, you will not forget it. And you will not forget it the way if you learn to ride a bicycle at 8, that at 80 you could get on the same bike. Well, you wouldn't have the same bike. You could get on a bike, and although you'll have to watch your balance a little more than you did at 8, you will remember how to ride it. Well, it turns out that with the art forms, if you learn them now, after 60, they will be with you forever, independent of whether there are some cognitive changes or losses or even mild to moderate dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And that is a fact. So this is really good to know. Now, you may not be able to remember still what you ate or stuff like that, but you will be able to remember your art form. And so wisdom accumulates, and the first time in life when it's available to you is the vintage years. And even if you look at famous artists, and in the book I decided to look at famous artists, people like Picasso, to see if their later years really were somehow more robust in terms of the art they produced. And they were. It was deeper. It was more passion. There was more pathos. Because if you live long enough, you're going to have all kinds of experiences. And you don't think about them, but they're there. And they come through your life experience and are expressed through your art form. So you can create music, writing, visual art in ways that young people cannot, period. Now, they may be more talented, but they won't have the depth. They can't, because you don't get the wisdom till this stage in life. And here's a picture of the brain, but not literal. Sometimes people say to me, but that is not anatomically correct. I say, yes, that's right, because it's a cartoon. But the point is that the right side is green, and you can't see all the detail here, but you know, there are people flying kites and playing flutes and reading and playing guitars and writing and just smelling the flowers. Well, that's the right brain. And the right brain is very active when you're young. And then later in life, it isn't as robust. It doesn't have the same capacity. But, well, I'm going to talk about the left brain first. The left brain is businesslike. And if you look there are a bunch of people sitting in cubicles with their computers, and it's all business. It's all like 1 + 1 always equals 2. And if you're an artist, you know that doesn't work. You know, 1 + 1 can be anything you want it to be. Again, you've got to think outside of the box. So the left brain is where a lot of facts are stored. And that is really important to us, because without that, you know, it's really impossible to live. But it doesn't make for creativity. Except in the later years, now, in the earlier years, the two sides of the brain function independently. So they are, while they're functionally independent, and later they become more interdependent. I hope I said that right. And what happens is, in midlife, the two sides of the brain start working together as they never have before. The only times that the two sides of the brain work together when you're not in the vintage years is where there is some kind of an anomaly in your brain and one side is able to take over and compensate for the other side. But routinely, for all of us, by midlife, the left brain starts to boost the right brain's function so that we can be more artistic than we could have otherwise. And so this bilaterality is where the two sides of the brain now work together to facilitate whatever you want. And there's also something that I mentioned earlier called patterning, where everything you ever has known is compressed and it's stored and you can retrieve it. The kind of knowledge particularly are called procedural memories. The procedural memories are the things you do, not like what I ate last night, but the things you do. And those things are very robust and powerful, and they're available to you pretty much forever. So that is really good to know. And that patterning is really only available later on because you don't know all that much when you're young. Think about it as storage for a computer. When you have a huge amount of storage, you need to somehow compress it so it is available to you in ways that it wouldn't be otherwise. And that happens in your brain automatically. And then hormones, as I mentioned before. So at this stage of life, you've got two sides of the brain working together. And when I started doing my research, even the scientists said two sides are better than one. So there you go. So here's a little decision-making tree from the book, Discovering Your Art Form. I have a couple of trees in the book. One of them really deals with should I retire or shouldn't I? Because that is a question for some people, irrelevant for others. But this one really deals with some personality factors. So I don't know how much you can see. But the two things I want to point out, because if I go through the whole thing, we'll be here all day, all night, I should say. There are differences between people. You need to understand your own personality when you start to figure out, what do I want to do with my vintage years? Some of us are more introverted and some are more extroverted. Depending on that, and what do I mean by that? Well, introverted people are people that enjoy their own company, that like doing things by themselves, and don't need encouragement, a lot of encouragement from others. Those people, if they want to write a book, they take out their laptop and they go sit under a tree and they start to write. They don't need classes. They don't need people reassuring them. They just do it. And so you need to know, are you like that? And I'm one of those. And it doesn't mean that introverts can't extrovert. I mean, I'm here talking in front of you. It's not easy for me to do, and I will have to retreat to my cave and recharge later, which introverts have to do. But that's fine. You just need to know yourself. Extroverts, on the other hand, need encouragement from others. They enjoy being around others. They want to take classes. They want to be with people who are like-minded, who they get strokes from, who they stroke, and it's all... very, very interesting time for them. So the other point I wanted to make is I want to talk about structure versus no structure. If you don't need structure, you just decide one day, well, I'm retiring in 8 days, and then I'm going to hang out and see what happens, and I'll go in the garden and watch the plants. And one thing leads to another, and for one of my... one of the people I may not have the time to show that slide today, but that person became a botanical watercolorist, but she started out going in her backyard looking at plants and being curious about flowers and the insides of flowers, and now when you look at her work, you look like you could reach in and grab a flower. So I don't want to spend too much time on this. This is Harold. Harold is in his mid-80s, he's 5'10", and this piece of art is stained glass, and it goes all the way to the floor, of course, and it's about 7 feet high. Harold, when he retired, He didn't know what to do with himself. He moved into a retirement plus 55 community, and he did some fix-up in his house. He dragged it out for about a year. And then one day he scratched his head and said, now what? He's an extrovert. He was a salesman all of his life. And so one day the community college continuing education brochure came, and he thought, that's what I got to do. I got to go over there. And when he went over there, the only class he could take was stained glass. Now, did he have an interest in stained glass? No. Did he have a history with this? No. He was a salesman all of his life. And he took the class, and he was smitten. He started making little things, then bigger things. Then he had a window in his garage. He took that out and put stained glass in, and then he started doing bigger things. And people noticed. And he lives in central New Jersey. He started doing these gigantic installations for churches and synagogues that made it look like Notre Dame. It was incredible. And he loved it because he also likes others' attention. He likes the appreciation. He doesn't charge for any of this, just for materials. And he loves it. And here's a picture of his studio in central New Jersey where he starts his art around 5 a.m. And he does his work until it's too hot, like 3 hours maybe. And in the winter, he does it in a space that's unheated, and he doesn't feel cold. He is so immersed in his art that he just doesn't even feel the cold. Now, I could tell you much more about each of these, but I think I'm going to have to hurry through. This is Charmion, and she plays the viola da gamba, which is a very exotic instrument and much harder than the cello. Okay. You want me to start wrapping up? Okay. So let me just say about her that she's 84. She lugs this thing around. It's bigger than the cello. It has 6 strings. She holds it between her knees because the ancient instruments, you didn't set them on the ground with a spike the way I do with my contemporary cello. I'm just going to fast forward through these. Okay.
We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Dr. Francine Toder on Finding the Vintage Years, Finding Your Artist, Inner Artist in the Vintage Years. Okay.
Okay, I'm going to just go through these slides because I want lots of time for your questions as well. So, and if you have questions about Charmion, I'll answer them later because I don't want to backtrack now. Mort does mixed media. This particular thing you're looking at has all kinds of depth and size. It's 10 feet wide and 8 feet high. And if you saw Mort, he's about 5'2" and he looks like a racehorse jockey. And he drags this art around. He is in his late 80s. He didn't start doing this until he was in his late 60s. And it was quite by accident. Every single piece of wood in that installation is hand-painted, and they all have different expressions on their faces. And there are some dogs and other animals interspersed. He has a very quirky sense of humor, and he uses that to infuse his art. He's an extroverted guy who gets a lot of attention for this, and although he wasn't looking for another career, what happened with him was that people noticed that he could do these gigantic installations, and he was asked by one of the high schools if he could do all their backdrops for plays. And he loves it, and he does it. He volunteers. I mean, he could stop whenever he wants, but he enjoys it because he's extroverted. He likes the attention. He likes the camaraderie. He likes being with people. Like all the others, he was just a delight. And no, again, he didn't start until his mid-60s. I mentioned the botanical watercolors. You can't see the detail in these flowers, but this picture now sits in a Delaware museum. She didn't start out as an artist. In fact, she was a computer programmer and lived for many years in Amsterdam, so she went to a lot of good museums. And maybe that affected her. And she appreciated art, but she also avoided art because her father was a well-known architect and painter, And often what I found is with people whose parents were successful artists, kids felt intimidated. But when her father was an old man, she came back to the United States to take care of him and watched him enjoy his art. And eventually he died, and she had to clean out his studio, which she always avoided because she just felt she had no talent. It certainly wasn't like him. So she started painting. She just picked up his stuff and started doing things with it. And after that, she realized that she enjoyed it, that she loved it. That's what she wanted to do with her time. How much time do we have before I need to stop talking? And
if you want to question, you need to stop.
Okay, well, here are some of the others. I'll run through real quick. And just one thing I need to say is, why the fine arts? It's a magic triad. This is my invention. After all of the research I distilled and everyone I talked to, novelty, complexity, and problem solving are really the three things, and the fine arts do it better than anything else. These ingredients create a robust tonic for the aging brain, available in abundance through writing, musical expression, and the fine arts. If we had more time, I'd tell you why golf is fine, and so is bridge, and so is knitting, and there are a lot of other things, but I still think that the fine arts gives you the most bang for your buck. So that's it, because this is all the time I have. Thank you.
Francine. Thank you so much, Francine. Since you are outside the box, as it is, will you stay and take questions from the audience?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, so we'll have a few questions. We'll run out of time. We'll have to stop at 6:15. But if you can take individual questions afterwards,
I would be happy
you'll
to.
You'll be outside the box, and I think you probably have some outside-the-box folks here. So
I'd be happy to stay.
All right. So is there anyone in the audience with a question for Francine? We'll pass the mic. Oh, please speak directly into it.
Oh, I just wanted to say that she made her own coat right here, and it's all also reversible. Yeah, it's reversible. Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you find that older people have an easier time getting published or, you know, their art being shown?
Only if it's at the senior center. Yeah. It's actually well, getting published is always difficult. It's definitely harder in the cultural climate that we live in, because a lot of people, if you're not an older person yourself, we tend to discount what an older person is really capable of. So I don't think it's easy. Some people actually do get discovered. And some people make their own way into fame, but that isn't the goal. It happens, though.
The first step, and I have to break in, Brent Nettle is the leader of Art for Elders here in San Francisco. This man has been dedicated to that for decades, and he does art exhibitions of artwork from elders, and they get in major venues. Art for Elders, look it up. If you're interested.
Over here. And
okay. Do you have any advice for people that are retired and kind of searching for that passion, that activity that they want to spend more time on? And it's like so broad, and there's so many options. Just trying to narrow it down and kind of get on with it.
Okay. Well, you don't have to worry about getting on with it, because you've got a gigantic life stage to fill. So I think we have to use vintageers thinking and not young people thinking. So there's no rush. And you can kind of meander around if you can tolerate it. In the book, I talk about what happens if you can't tolerate it. You know, there are certain kinds of activities that you can do, sort of meditational kinds of things, to breathing kinds of things, to kind of keep the anxiety from coming up about, I should do something, but I don't know what it is. Often people just start out living their lives and being curious. That is sort of the number one thing to be, is curious. Watch, look. This is the stage of life where we can actually watch and look. You can't do that before this. Kids are very distractible. Adults are very busy. This is the first stage where you can really watch and look and see what appeals to you. Look at what other people are doing. Read some things that other people have written about, you know, their artist journey. And just see what appeals to you. And by the way, where you start is not where you're going to go. You just want to get on the path. You don't know where it's going to take you.
I like when you said it really doesn't matter the talent at our age. And I retired a couple of years ago, and I was turning 70 very soon, and decided then that I need to do something crazy. So I bought me a little kiln and put some tiles, raw tiles, and I did my doodling, crazy painting, and it was just wonderful. Suddenly I realized that I have about 50 or 60 of them. What the hell am I going to do with them? So I decided to, I'm not going to tell you where I live, that I would go in the middle of the night into the city, glue the suckers into the wall. So if you see a tile that it has, you know, just colors, I have so much fun going in the middle of the night trying to make sure that the police doesn't get me or stand by. But I think it's our time to really, really let it go and find pleasure and happiness.
That's
because I think I'm originally from Chile, and I just saw an incredible graffiti that says, "You are the time that you have left."
Wow.
Eres el tiempo que te queda. Thank you so much for yours.
Thank you. I think you need to come on tour with me, because I need somebody who can say that.
The problem with the last gentleman is I'm a friend of his, and I'm afraid that we'll be arrested. And I'm trying to disassociate. I've actually seen his work placed in various places in the city. And in a more serious light, I'm a great admirer of two things. One, his talent. And two, and I don't mean this facetiously, the audacity to do it. I think that's fantastic. I'm a little scared, but I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. I agree entirely. I think also that you need to, you know, pay attention to some of the consequences, but not too many at this stage.
I wonder how many people here have been to Burning Man, and actually if you've been to Burning Man, because more and more older people keep showing up to Burning Man, and the conditions are really, really harsh out in the desert in the middle of summer, but there's so much art and creativity there, and people just get together and create when they go back to whatever city they're from. But Burning Man, this is the headquarters, this is where it is. This is where it is, there's where we have so many art studios around the city. And I'm wondering, have you been to Burning Man?
No, I haven't. But I have heard about it. And
unfortunately, we've reached... No, Candice, don't argue with me. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where we have time for only one last question. Ooh. However,
but I'm
Dr.
stay.
Toter will stay, and you have books...
That's the other thing.
Autograph books?
I have books that you can buy, and I will autograph.
We're nearly sold out with the ones that we had here, because people coming in bought them. But you have some more?
We did bring a few.
Okay.
And we will, yes, happily.
Okay, so one more question. We'll close the program, and then we're going outside the box.
When I applied to a local art school last month to study interior design, they and I was born in 1948, but their options for ages only went to 1950. Mm-hmm. So that was my first problem with the place. And then the second one is I'm worried about being amongst really fast-thinking, computer-savvy kids while I study. But I think I'm getting a little bit of the answer from your talk, which is to stop worrying about it.
Absolutely. And I we may be off the air now, but let me just, in answering this, say that One of the artists in the book is a guy who was an ophthalmologist and practiced medicine for 30 years. And as soon as he retired, and I can't go into his whole history, he decided he was going to go to art, four-year art school. So he enrolled here in San Francisco in a four-year art school for a bachelor's degree. Now remember, this guy had a bachelor's, a master's, and he had an MD degree. And he went back at 62 to start a four-year degree program. And he said, almost invariably, every class he was in, people would think he was the instructor. You know, he was the oldest one in every single class. He had to deal with a lot of sort of ageism kinds of things. But he just graduated a month ago, and he's finished his 4 years, and now he's embarked on a career that sort of has no name. It really doesn't matter. But one of the things he said is, everyone in the class, all the young people, were worried about what are they going to do with this art? How will they make a living? How will they market it? How will they, you know, this and that and all the things. He said, I didn't have to deal with any of it. So that is the freedom that you get at this stage of life. And eventually what happened was people began to see that he really was an interesting guy, notwithstanding how old he was. And so it sort of reversed some of the stereotypes. Good luck to you.
Our thanks to Dr. Francine Toder, author of The Vintage Years, for her comments here today. And we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.